Welcome to the Faster Podcast by Flow Cycling, the podcast where we talk about anything and everything that makes you faster on your bike. This is episode 18, and today we have Dr. Robert Chapman from USA Track and Field joining us on the show. Dr. Chapman, an altitude expert, has been studying how altitude affects both training and racing for more than 20 years. Listen to this episode to learn how to best perform at high altitude races and how to use an altitude training camp to help you become a faster cyclist. Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, Dr. Chapman, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Doing all right. How are you?
Very good. Rumor has it you were born and raised in Las Vegas. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true.
All right. John and I spent a lot of years there. John actually still lives there. So were you, yep. What part? Were you Henderson or Summerlin?
No, actually, I was born in Vegas, lived there till I was about 12 or 13, then moved to Boulder City and actually lived out in Boulder City for a number of years till I came out here to Indiana.
Awesome. Very cool. Very cool. Well, this episode on altitude training, I'm very excited to do this. And I have to say that we are very honored to have you on this show because I don't think it's possible to look up anything online with altitude training without finding your name in the footnotes or a quote or something from you. So you're definitely well versed in this topic. And we're really looking forward to this episode. And I think our listeners will too. So I did quite a bit of research for this interview, and I will warn you that most of my research came from Dr. Randall Wilbur's Altitude Training and Athletic Performance book,
So
I think some of those studies are a little bit outdated, and there's probably a lot more studies since the publication of that, which I think was about 15 years ago. Yeah. So excuse me if I'm a little off on some of the research, but it is hard to find some great information on this. And that was a really good book to start with. So
it is a good one to start with, no doubt. Randy does really good work.
Yeah, I know. His name is also one of the ones that continually comes up with this topic. So cool. Let's just start with the basics of oxygen deprivation at elevation. I think most people get this, but for those who are unfamiliar with what happens when you go up in elevation to oxygen, just let us know the basics of that.
So what happens when you go up is primarily pressure changes, barometric pressure changes. The oxygen content, if you look from a percentage basis, whether you are in Las Vegas, Bloomington, Indiana, Flagstaff, Arizona, it's all the same. It's about 21%. But what changes is the pressure, barometric pressure, when you go up. And if you multiply the barometric pressure times the fractional gas concentration, that 21%, that gets you what's called a partial pressure of oxygen, and that's what the body is sensitive to. So as you go up, that lower pressure means essentially that a lower partial pressure of oxygen is going to be in your lungs, going to get into your blood, and ultimately get delivered to the tissues. And then that's why performance is impaired, and that's why there's physiological adaptations that take place to try to deal with that.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'm going to cover the basics of physiology here, and I'm going to start with my understanding of it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I just want to give the listeners a basic understanding of why the physiology behind this is important. So with aerobic sports, obviously, our ability to utilize oxygen is a key predictor of how well we're going to do. And my understanding of this is that there are really two systems in the body that help deliver and then utilize oxygen. So we have the central system, which is our heart and lungs, and that basically oxygenates the blood and sends it out to the muscles. And then you have the peripheral system, which takes the oxygen from the blood and delivers it to the muscles. And I think that's primarily the capillaries in your muscles. So obviously, the more efficient both of those systems are, the higher our VO2 max and our ability to use oxygen. Is that a good basic description of it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, everything in the body, as you know, is a lot more complicated, and it's hard to boil it down into, you know, index card type of stuff that checks the box. But that's okay. A pretty good. You did a nice job. That's a pretty good way to frame it.
Okay, cool. So for our level of understanding here, we'll go with your heart and lungs deliver it and your muscles use it, essentially.
That works.
Okay, cool. So really, the goal with altitude training is to increase the capacity of both the central system and the peripheral system that we talked about. So can you give us a simplified theory on what altitude training does?
So I would actually frame it a little different than central and peripheral.
Okay.
I would frame it as I always talk about an acclimatization response and a training response.
Okay.
And so there's different aspects to living at altitude and training to altitude in terms of how your body responds.
Okay.
And when you live at altitude, the number one primary factor that we feel in the scientific community, in the applied sport physiology community, affects exercise performance is increasing EPO, which causes an increase in total hemoglobin mass or red blood cells, so you can deliver more oxygen.
Okay.
So essentially a natural form of blood doping.
Okay.
If you will. You know, I know blood doping has a negative connotation. I only mean it in the broadest terms. You're increasing the amount of hemoglobin in your body and you're doing it naturally.
Okay.
Okay. The trade-off with this is if you're going to live at altitude, in most cases, you have to train at altitude. And now there's a question of, are there adaptations that take place at altitude that are beneficial to performance when you train there? And the answer to that is a little bit more confusing in terms of the literature. Because if you go back to even the earliest studies that were done in the 60s and 70s, The data that came out of them, you know, first off, there were some problems with a lot of it. There wasn't really good controls and difficult to measure certain things. But a lot of studies showed essentially no change. So you have all these athletes training at altitude, but then you have all these research studies showing, well, there's no difference in performance. And a lot of the reason why is that I think people have this connotation that if you starve the muscle of oxygen, the muscle is going to adapt in a way to be able to better process oxygen.
Okay.
And when you're talking about, if I just do, let's say, single leg exercise or single arm exercise, small muscle mass, where I've got boatloads of cardiac output that I can deliver there, then to a certain degree, that is true. If you starve the muscle of oxygen, yes, you're going to see peripheral adaptations. Okay. But when you talk about whole body dynamic exercise, like cycling, like running, like rowing, like swimming, things like that, it's exactly the opposite. Is that if you starve the muscle of oxygen, the muscle is actually going to detrain because essentially it's overbuilt to handle the amount of oxygen you're delivering to it. So the extreme example I always give is imagine instead of just going to altitude like in Flagstaff or Colorado Springs, let's say you go to the summit of Mount Everest. At the summit of Mount Everest, VO2 max exercise is you take a step and you stop and rest for 30 seconds and you take another step. Well, if I trained in that way, do you think my muscles are going to adapt to process oxygen better? No, they're overbuilt essentially. So that becomes the problem, is these balances between how you're going to live at altitude and get the benefits from living at altitude that are beneficial performance, along with the training adaptation side, which in some cases could be a benefit and in some cases could be a negative for performance. And it's the balance between the two that ultimately is going to determine how much your performance improves.
Okay. All right. So there's a line in Dr. Werbel's book that says there's no conclusive evidence that altitude training leads to performance at sea level. That was 15 years ago. Would you agree with that statement or disagree at this point?
At the time that Randy wrote it, it was a very true statement that if you took the bulk of the scientific literature, that was probably the key take-home message. Since then, there's been a number of additional studies done, including some meta-analyses that essentially are designed to statistically look at all the available literature that fits a certain criteria so that we can get a kind of a true answer. And if you look at that, there are certain types of altitude training, specifically this live high, train low model of altitude training that has been shown to repeatedly significantly enhance sea level performance, assuming certain controls are done in the right way.
Okay, so the rest of this podcast makes sense then. That's good.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so you actually mentioned protocols, and that's my next question. So there are several protocols. You have the live high, train high, live high, train low. Then there's the high, high, low, where you live high, you do your base easy miles at high elevation, then you do your high intensity intervals at low elevation. Can you talk about the differences between these protocols and explain which is most effective?
Sure. So live high, train high is what many people would think of as classical altitude training. You go to altitude, you stay there, you live there, you train there until you're done, and then you leave and come home.
Okay.
With live high, train low, this was really a concept that was invented, so to speak, and researched to a very high level initially by my colleagues Ben Levine and Jim Strae-Gunderson, who I did my postdoc with.
Okay.
Their whole philosophy was essentially what I was talking a little bit with my Mount Everest analogy is we shouldn't be starving the muscle of oxygen during training. We should be sending as much as we possibly can, and that's going to cause the system to adapt to make more mitochondria and make more capillaries. So what if we live at altitude to get all the benefits of it, but then when we train, we drive down on the off the mountain as low as possible, train as close to sea level as we can, and that's going to be the most effective way to enhance performance. And I could take you through the history of all their research, but essentially it's been shown not only by Ben's lab, by my lab, by Australian labs, by Gregor Amelet in Switzerland and a number of others to be very effective.
Okay.
More effective than live high, train high. And live high, train high is essentially a crapshoot. And what I mean by that is some people are going to get better, some people are going to get worse, but the average is you're probably going to be the same as if you just stayed at home and trained at sea level for the average individual.
Okay.
The problem with the live high, train low model is that it kind of sucks getting in the car every day and driving down the mountain. And so the next iteration was, well, what if we only did it on the high intensity interval workout days? If you're just doing a gentle recovery run, recovery ride, whatever it may be, just stay up high so that you're not burdened with travel. And then for those quality workouts, you go low. And that's the high, high, low model. Okay. And we found essentially that the improvement in performance at sea level after a 28-day altitude camp was exactly the same as doing every day live high, train low. So now we have a more logistically simplified model to make it more palatable to more athletes. And now you add in more locations. So now if you live in certain areas, you know, we always did it in Park City, Salt Lake City, which is an easy 30, 45 minute drive, but we do it in Flagstaff down to Sedona or Camp Verde, which again is 45 minutes, pretty easy. Now you can have more places where if I've got to drive 2 hours, but I only have to do it 2 days a week, well, that's a little more palatable to do it. So lots of benefits from doing the high, high, low model.
Perfect.
So I'm trying to think of the geographical constraints and you're kind of touching on that. So I guess you could look at it a couple ways. First, you could look at it, what is the most optimal height for you to live? And then what's the most optimal height to train at? But is that what we're looking at? Or are we looking at a discrepancy in height? So let's say we're training at sea level, but we're 3,000 feet up. Could we also live at 6,000 feet and then train at 3,000? How does that work?
Yeah. So, you know, what you're asking is exactly what we do in the lab. So it's the next logical step. So now after we did high, high, low, people ask, well, the next question is, well, how high is high enough?
Yeah.
And how low is low enough? So the next study we did is we actually had a group where we went to the Park City, Utah area, and we put a group at 6,000 feet to live, a group at 7,000 feet, a group at 8,000 feet, and a group at 9,000 feet. And we got them together to train every day for 28 days. At the same elevation, whether it was high or low. But then when they got done with training, they went back to their base elevation of between, again, 6,000 and 9,000 feet.
Yeah.
And essentially what we found, like, it's kind of the Goldilocks principle. You want not too hot, not too cold, just right.
Yep.
Same thing with altitude. It turns out 6,000 feet is a little too low.
Okay.
primarily in terms of making new red blood cells. 7,000 and 8,000 feet gave the best improvement in performance. And it turned out that 9,000 feet, to our surprise a little bit, actually is a little too high, where performance was not significantly improved after return to sea level. And the number of extra red blood cells they made was not significantly more at 9,000 than 8 or 7. And there's, as you know, the higher you live, the more negatives there are with sleep disruption, ventilatory acclimatization, things like that. So that's tricky for athletes, because athletes are always, well, if 7,000 feet's good, then 9 or 10,000 feet must be great.
Must be great,
And it turns out it's not. That's not the case at all. So optimal altitude appears to be somewhere in the 7 to 8,000 foot range. How low is low enough is, and I know we're going to talk a little bit later about individual responses, just... All we can say is that when we go down to Salt Lake City, which is 4,200 feet, we see an improvement. It's better than staying up high. Would it be even better if we could go lower down to sea level? We believe the answer is yes, but there's not a lot of data out there, at least in our hands, to support it. So we can say 7,000 to 8,000 feet is the ideal altitude. Try to get as low as you can. But we know that if you go to 4,000 feet, that appears to be low enough.
Man, some of you poor scientists are just going to have to go live in Maui for a while and do a study on Haleakala. That would be a terrible assignment, right?
That would be rough. Or if we could just get a little bit higher place in LA where you could live, if Big Bear was just a little higher and you could drive down and do your runs on the beach, you know.
Nice.
I was on the top of Haleakala last week, actually. It was that's pretty cool. I would not want to make that drive every day. It was very cool though. As far as the studies, how long did it take in order to see a performance improvement in the athletes you were studying in Park City?
Performance is a different animal.
Performance at sea level.
Yeah, performance at sea level. So now you're asking, how long do you have to live? How long does your camp have to be before you see a performance improvement?
Right.
That's what you're asking, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So here's where the data from my lab and my colleague's lab, Ben Levine and others, differ a little bit from some of the data that's out there from the Australian groups. If you read the Australian groups, they think the response in terms of red cell production and time at altitude is a linear response. Meaning for every so many hours at altitude, you're going to see a so much percent increase in total hemoglobin mass. Our viewpoint is it's probably a little different. How your bones go through the process of erythropoiesis, making new red cells, is extremely complicated. There are a number of things that can affect it. There are things that turn it on and off, and they're remarkably quick, meaning... if I go to altitude for 2 days, is it like people think it's like an EPO injection, so to speak? and it's really not the case. Yes, when you go for 2 days, your EPO is going to go up, but as soon as you go back down to sea level, the body senses it. It turns it off right away, and any sort of process in the bones to go from what's called a stem cell through the process to making a red blood cell, you might only be, you know, 2 steps out of 14 along the way. If the EPO goes away, it's going to say, well, why are we doing this? And it'll actually scavenge those materials that you started with and recycle them, and you're starting all back over again.
Okay.
So it's very complicated. Our viewpoint is that if you're going to go to altitude to train in a camp situation, the bare minimum amount of time you want to spend is 21 days. Okay. We feel confident that for most people, 21 days at altitude, if you are a typical responder to altitude, you will see an improvement in total hemoglobin mass, number of red cells that you have, which if you train following the live high, train low philosophy, should lead to an improvement in performance.
And is that continual? If you stay 42 days, is it better than 21? Is there a cap?
Great question. So we've got data up until roughly about 30 days. We feel comfortable saying 21 days is the minimum. We like 28 days as being kind of the standard. Okay. What you ask is a really good question, because there's a fair amount of data on people going to altitude for 3 to 4 weeks. there's not a lot of data beyond that because it takes money to do all these studies. And at some point you got to go, you know what, we're done. So one of the things I'm trying to do, I'm actually out in Flagstaff next week to meet with some colleagues at Northern Arizona University. And they're in a really unique situation because they have people who move to Flagstaff on their own volition all the time in students who actually leave for certain period of times and then come back. And just be able to use them to kind of track what's happening with EPO, what's happening with hemoglobin mass. It would be really fascinating to kind of get some of these timing issues down using a population like that, where you don't have to logistically, in this case, pay to support their housing and everything else. So yeah, it's a ready-built model, and I think we can get some answers to those questions hopefully here pretty soon.
Well, I live at sea level now. If I ever move to Park City, I'll call you and you can study me.
Yeah. So there's, I guess that begs another question then. So you said that if you've gone up to elevation for like a day or two, people think they get an EPO injection. That's not the case.
Right.
If somebody's been up at elevation for, let's say, 30 days,
yep,
does that prolong the effect after they return to sea level? And so if you're thinking about it from a, like a race perspective,
right,
is there a optimal number of days that you would say, hey, I've been up here for 30 days. I want to come back down to hit my race on what day? How long do those last?
Absolutely. Great question. So this is actually something we've been very interested in my lab. I call it the black hole in altitude training research. We feel like we've got a handle on how high should you live, how long should you stay, how low should you train, what should you do with iron supplements, what should you do with diet, all those things for the camp. We feel like we've got it figured out. But then it's a complete, absolute guess of, well, should I come down a day before, 2 days before, a week before, 10 days? How do we figure that out? One of the really interesting things is what happens to red blood cells when you leave altitude and you come back down. And it's the general thing to keep in mind is it's very hard to trick the body. When you try to do it, the body figures it out and it has adaptive mechanisms to just turn off whatever you've done. So as soon as you come back to sea level, the body goes, wait a minute, we've got all these extra red blood cells. And there's a mechanism called neocytolysis, neo being new and cytolysis meaning death to red blood cells. So essentially what the body does is it has a way, when it senses that you have an overexpression of red blood cells in the body, it will selectively scavenge the newest, youngest red blood cells and pull them out of your blood. Your new red blood cells have these things on them called surface adhesion molecules. And when EPO is suppressed below baseline, it is a mechanism for those cells to get targeted and pulled out. Point of all this is you would think that the decay rate of your red blood cells should fall under whatever the natural death rate is of a red blood cell. Red blood cells live usually about 90 to 120 days, and so you would think it would just follow that nice slow decline. It's actually much faster. You're back down to where you were when you started, somewhere between 20 to 30 days after being down.
Okay.
So now in the timing question, it's, okay, should I compete right away, day one, when my red blood cells are the highest? In some cases, that might be a yes. Some people feel that you should wait a little bit. One of the advantages of waiting is, think about this. You come down from altitude, you have all these extra red blood cells, your VO2 max is higher. Guess what happens to your workouts for the next 2 weeks? You can just absolutely bury those workouts. And so even though your red blood cells are starting to decay, you're getting the advantage of these, your really killer workouts for 2 weeks, and your fitness is going up. And there are some people who are actually more fit in terms of performance after 14, 21 days back at sea level than they were on day one, coming down when they had more red blood cells.
Oh, because they can train harder.
Because you can train harder. And then there is the ventilatory acclimatization piece. So when you go to altitude, one of the other adaptations we haven't talked about is you upregulate your ventilation. You'll breathe more at any given power output, any given workload. When you come back down, it takes time for that extra ventilation to go away. Yeah. And because of that extra ventilation going away, in general, ventilation's a tricky one, because the more you ventilate, in theory, the more oxygen you might be able to get into your lungs, push across into your blood, to deliver to your muscles, but that requires work of your respiratory muscles. And if your respiratory muscles are doing work, they need blood flow. And where are they, quote unquote, stealing the blood flow? Well, they're stealing it from your legs to be able to do it. It's actually a measurable phenomenon. It's got a fancy name called the metaboreflex. So if you can actually wait until that extra ventilation goes away, that might be a better thing for you. So what I've kind of, the recommendation I give is that in the world of track and field, if you're a marathon or 10K athlete, the data suggest you might be a little better off competing right away within 24, 48, 72 hours after you come down.
Okay.
If you're in more of a middle distance type event, 1500 meters, 5K, maybe up to the 10K, I think most athletes are going to get a benefit from timing it where they compete about 21 days out of being down. And that's something that we actually did going into Rio, working with a lot of our top distance runners. Is in the time leading in, we did some really careful measurements with them and looked at their race performances. And we were able to kind of titrate in, okay, here's when you need to working backwards. Here's the day you need to come down to get 28 days. Here's the day you need to go up, because we know this is the window where you're going to feel the best. Here's the workout tweaks you need to do in that time. For guys like Evan Jaeger, for example, who won the silver in the 3,000 meter steeplechase, we knew absolutely around day 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 of coming down, the guy was money.
Yeah.
So we just, everything was designed around that, and it worked out.
Nice.
Cool.
Nice.
So you've mentioned that it's sort of a black hole, and it sounds like it's not, I mean, it sounds like you have some light in that hole. You've got done quite a bit of research. It just begs the question, when you're at elevation and you're doing the high-low training, what marker are you using for performance improvement? Is that the red blood cell count? What are you looking at?
Well, performance for us is always performance. So it's going to be typically, if we're talking about runners, we're going to do a performance trial, 3,000 meters, 5,000 meters on the track. If we're using cyclists in our lab, typically we've done anything from 4K time trials to 40K time trials.
Okay.
But it's always going to be time as the measure of performance. And then we're going to look at the other physiological markers, whether it's total hemoglobin mass, VO2, ventilation, things of that nature, okay, to try to see if we can get an idea of the mechanism that support those performance outcomes.
Okay. And so those other identifiers like hemoglobin mass and things like that allow you to factor out the training that's happening at the camp. Because in theory, I mean, if you're just training at a training camp, you get faster when you train. So did those other markers allow you to better understand the performance, or do you have a compare and contrast? You have another target group that's not at elevation.
Yeah. So that when you talk about research, this is the big issue, particularly with the early studies in altitude training research, because in many cases, they either A, didn't have a control group that did equivalent training at sea level, or when they started the study, you would have athletes who would come in where you had no idea what fitness they were in. So you don't know if the improvement was due to altitude or if the improvement was just due to, well, they
training
for and got better. There's also something called the group training effect that you guys know well. When you get people together to train, they get better. And then there's also something called the training camp effect, meaning even if I'm doing the same workouts, but I'm doing them at home versus if I, you know, go away to a training camp where, you know, the phone doesn't ring and people aren't bothering me and I can really focus on what I need to do, you know, Rocky in Siberia before he fought the Russian, you know, type of thing, you get better. So to find a way to control all of those things ends up being a real challenge at times with designing these studies.
Okay. And so that begs the question, does this work as well for an elite athlete versus an amateur athlete?
Yeah, so that certainly one of the criticisms of the early work that was done by my colleagues when I joined them was the runners that they use for these studies, I would call them very average collegians.
Okay.
And one of the advantages I had is I had connections in the elite track and field world and was able to design a study that we completed way back in 1997. Where now we had people who were all ranked top 20 in the U.S. We had three U.S. Olympians in the group. And essentially, we saw the same performance improvement. And the collegians would live high, train low is about 1.5% improvement in performance. In the elite group, it was 1.1%.
Okay.
So, you know, again, as long as you meet the underlying principles of, you know, having adequate iron stores and things of that before you start the camp, do live high, train low. On average, it's going to be between 1 and 1.5% for the bulk of people.
Awesome. So we had an expert on the show a while back, Jessica from, she has a thing with Run DNA. They were doing some things, doing a lot of genetic testing.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've done with genetics or trying to understand, does altitude training work better on other people? Or is there any identifier that says, hey, this worked really well for one person, or is it across the board universal?
No, there's definitely a wide inter-individual variation in the response, whether it is EPO release to a given altitude, whether it is the ventilatory response, hypoxia, performance, you name it. It's pretty broad. I want to give you one example with the work that I do for USA Track and Field. We've tested close to 100 elite athletes who have gone into either Flagstaff or Park City to train. There's one guy in particular who we've tested three different times at three different altitudes, and the guy makes zero change he makes EPO, but his red cell mass does not change. He stays exactly the same every time. You know, so for him, it's the question of, okay, is there a benefit of going to altitude for the training camp, being with the rest of the group, or is it better for him just to stay in Portland and train and be with his wife and, you know, not worry about it? But if you try to figure out, and there's another female on his team who is absolutely unbelievable. She'll have, every time we've tested her, again, two or three times, she's above 10% increase in hemoglobin mass.
Whoa,
is massive. The average is roughly about 4%. She's 10% every time. So what makes them different? We very much have tried to figure that out. And at least with the techniques that were available to us over the last few years to be able to do it, we haven't been able to identify a marker or a SNP in the genetic code that would say you're going to be a responder or a non-responder to altitude. We've had to do it more the old-fashioned way of, okay, let's have you go, let's test your response, and then let's see, do you fit?
See
or
what
not
happens.
Fit.
Have you noticed?
Then the tweak becomes then also, are there interventions we can do? And this is the latest thing we're doing in our lab. I've got a couple of PhD students working on these sort of projects of, are there interventions we can do to cause you to make more EPO at any given fixed altitude? So, for example, there's things like zinc deficiency may play a role in how much EPO you make. There are certain sort of antioxidants which may cause you to make more EPO at a given altitude. And so we're actually doing some work in my lab using altitude tents here at sea level to see if we can give athletes, okay, if you do this and do this, in addition to going to altitude, you're really going to maximize your response.
Cool. Have you noticed any specific difference between men and women?
The only issue between men and women is even if you make a significant amount of EPO at altitude, if you are iron deficient, you're not going to make additional red blood cells. So the biggest issue that we have, and this was a problem in a lot of the early research, is they didn't screen for serum ferritin to make sure that they were iron loaded before they went. And that's the number one thing that we have to try to control for, both in our studies and we try to get athletes to do before they go. And as a general rule, women tend to be about three or four times more likely to be iron deficient at any given point, particularly in the endurance population, than men. So other than that, that's about the only key difference we see.
So if you're anemic, no go.
If you're anemic, definitely don't go. But it's beyond anemic. It's even, you could have normal hemoglobin hematocrit, but have a ferritin of 10 nanograms per milliliter below, and that's a problem. You're going to be wasting your time at altitude.
Okay. So really, I mean, if you're looking at a well-trained amateur athlete or an elite athlete, it may, if they live at altitude, they may have a distinct advantage over somebody who lives at sea level if they respond well to altitude training.
No question. Absolutely. Okay. Now the question becomes, if you live at altitude full time, do you do sea level camps? Simply because now you can come down and again, have those really high intensity workout periods of time where you can,
that's a really good point.
Crank your fitness up. So it now becomes periodization, you know, in terms of time of year and when you want to maximize it and things like that. Awesome. Same thing with sea level people going up is everybody thinks of altitude as just prior to your main competition at sea level. But another key time that a lot of our elite distance runners are doing now is they've realized the value of doing it at the end of a base phase right before they're going to start doing some high intensity stuff. And it's kind of like a booster for them to be able to handle that high intensity work a little bit better, recover a little better, and get through that training.
That's cool. Really smart. That's clever. That's cool. All right. So we've talked a lot about altitude training. That's one thing. I want to shift gears a little bit now and talk about traveling to a high elevation race and how athletes can adapt for that optimally and how we can adjust our performance and all those types of things. So let's just start with, let's say we live at 3,000 feet. We'll use Vegas as an example because that's about 3,000 feet in Summerlin. How much of a delta or a change in altitude should you be concerned about? So if you live at 3,000 feet and you race at 3,500 feet, I'm sure that's not an issue. How big of a jump should you start to worry about your performance?
Oh, that's a really good question. The answer is a little bit different if you're talking about an elite endurance athlete versus a lesser individual. So the delta is going to be smaller the more elite you get. That's a really tough one to try to zero in on because you could make an argument that every 100 feet you go up, oxygen delivery is going to be impaired and you would be slower. Now, how big does it have to get where that variance becomes bigger than the other 42 things that are going to affect your performance?
Okay.
And you're probably, you know, ballpark, you're probably talking about 1,500, 2,000 feet is probably it.
Okay.
There was this idea of going way back of a threshold altitude. Meaning we used to teach people, based on some research in the 70s and 80s, that there was a threshold altitude. It was roughly about 1,500 meters, about 5,000 feet. And until you got to 5,000 feet, you weren't affected. But then above 5,000 feet, you were going to be negatively affected for every, you know, 100 meters you went up in elevation.
Okay.
And over the years, work that my lab – oh, sorry about that, guys.
It's all good.
Work that my lab's done and my colleagues have done, we found that if you're talking about untrained individuals, that may be the case. But if you're talking about elite endurance athletes, you're essentially affected as soon as you ascend from sea level. So there's been some data that shows, I've got data out of my lab that shows even at 600 to 900 meters, so you're talking 1,800 to 2,000 feet, you're going to see a decrement in performance compared to the same individual being at sea level.
Interesting.
So you're right. It is the delta that's important. And it's just a question of how small. I'd say probably 1,500 feet is the small end.
Okay. All right. So as we talked about in the beginning of the show, you have that partial pressure of oxygen that goes down and that affects your performance as you go up. So I've got a table here. As I think Joe Friel did it, but it talks about how much performance you lose, you know, at elevation. So We just did a show on Leadville. So let's use that as an example. That race starts at about 10,000 feet. And this table says that at 10,000 feet, if you're non-acclimatized, you have about 79% of your sea level power. And once you're acclimatized, you've got about 84% of that sea level power. Would you agree with that in general?
Yeah. The key with this now becomes you're talking about individual responses again. It means, and this table is going to give you what the average typical person might see. So now the question becomes how do individuals adapt in that? And you're going to have some people on either end of that bell curve.
Okay.
So if you want to know how a typical person is going to go, then I would say absolutely. I apologize. I don't know why. I think that's my computer that's making that noise.
Yeah, we don't hear it on our end, so you're good.
Yeah, we don't hear it.
You don't hear it on your end. Okay,
no,
I'm sorry.
No,
that's
worries.
Mine. Sorry. If you're talking about, if you want a general rule of thumb about how everybody's going to respond, you know, it'd kind of like be saying, well, how much, you know, how many miles a week should a runner run? Well, you should run 80 miles a week.
Right.
You
know,
as a collegiate athlete, you should run 80 miles a week. Well, some people are going to be fine at 50. Some people need 120. You know, it's the same sort of deal. You're going to see some variation in there. And probably the number one reason or the number one thing that affects it is going to be what we call oxyhemoglobin saturation.
Right.
How much oxygen you end up getting into your blood.
Okay, so that was kind of my next question is it really depends on how well you saturate your blood with oxygen, right?
Right.
Okay, and so is there a test or something that we can do to say, hey, I saturate well or I don't saturate well?
Yeah, so we can actually get a pretty good estimate of that in the lab. You could put in an arterial line, draw arterial blood. You don't want to do that.
Okay.
The easiest way to estimate it is use what's called a pulse oximeter.
Yep.
Which is, if you've ever seen the devices, fit over
got
your
one.
Fingertip.
I've got it.
Yeah. Now, here's the trick is, you know, those devices have gotten to be pretty cheap, and they're really designed to tell, you know, in the health world, we care if you're 90 or 85 or 80. You know, we don't care if you're 82 or 83. You know what I mean? So the accuracy of the devices get sacrificed a little bit for the cost benefit of doing it. So in the lab, we use some devices that are a little more powerful, pulse oximeters that have a little more hardware to them that allow us to get a little bit better estimation of what it is. But if they also tend to be very sensitive to motion artifact. So as you're, you know, riding on the bike, if your finger twitches a little bit, you know, you're going to see the number just dance all over the place. So
okay.
It's doable, but you got to be careful and do it right.
Okay. So for the general guy who's listening to this and says, okay, I'm at sea level, he puts the pulse ox on, he's 98, right?
Yep.
He goes to 10,000 feet and he's, the average guy is going to see what at 10,000 feet, 85?
Well,
90?
You're talking about rest or exercise. What ends up being important is what you do during exercise. And here's the amazing thing is even before you get there to altitude is, and here's the best way to describe it is, if you think about how long a red blood cell has while it's in the lung to pick up oxygen, we call that transit time of a red blood cell in the lung. It's actually unbelievably short. During maximal exercise, it's about a quarter of a second. That's it. When you train, one of the well-known adaptations that takes place when you train is your stroke volume gets bigger, your maximal cardiac output gets bigger. But the amount of pulmonary capillary blood volume, the amount of tubing in your lungs, if you will, doesn't change with training. It stays the same. So now when you train, you're basically pumping more blood per minute through the same volume of tubing, which means the blood has to move through faster.
Okay.
So now instead of being 0.25 seconds, it might go down to 0.2 seconds or 0.18 seconds.
Yep.
And in some individuals, that is so fast that oxygen doesn't have enough time to diffuse across and fill all the binding sites on hemoglobin. So now those athletes, instead of being 98% when they're doing maximal exercise at sea level, we've had some people in our lab who've been 87, 86, 85%, which would be like your normal individual who has plenty of transit time, if you will, in their lungs, going to Leadville and do an exercise, and they're going to be 80%.
Okay, so if you do that test, and let's say you're below 85, then you would be on the low side of this table. But if you're higher than that, you may get a little more performance than the average person.
So if you're able to maintain your saturation at a high level during maximal exercise, even at sea level, then you're more likely to be able to maintain it at altitude, which means you're going to be less negatively affected at altitude.
Awesome.
But we can do this test at sea level and tell right away, okay, listen, you're going to be okay at altitude. Altitude is going to kick your butt. You know, it's in a lot of athletes, it's very clear cut like that.
Okay. And by maximal exercise, you mean like a VO2 max test or just a really hard threshold type effort?
Either one. We could do an incremental test to exhaustion, or we could say, all right, you know, we're going to do an all out, 8K effort, you know, on the bike, and we're going to look at you at the last 60 seconds, you know, the last K of the ride and see where you are.
Okay. My last question on this, if you're at sea level, good responders can hold what number? 97, 98?
When it's not really a responder non-responder thing, but
good again, saturators. Because,
yeah, good. Where we always say the cutoff is when it comes to altitude is about 92%. So if you're above 92% during maximum exercise at sea level, those people tend to be in the group that goes to altitude and doesn't see as much performance decline. If you're below 92%, then you're in trouble.
Okay, perfect. I know a lot of guys who are going to love that number you just gave them, so thank you. Okay, let's talk about going to your race and acclimatizing. So you hear this, you know, race within 24 hours or 3 weeks. Yep. What's your theory on that, and what's the best way to acclimatize for a high elevation race like Leadville?
So we heard the same thing, and we said, all right, let's do a study and try to figure that out. So actually one of my PhD students did this, and we published it last year in 2017, and it was really kind of a neat study. What he did is we set up an altitude tent in the lab, and we brought in cyclists, and we had them sleep overnight in the lab and then do a 20K time trial on the bike. And we had three different conditions. The first one was a control condition where they slept at sea level, and then they rode the 20K at sea level. The other one we called it, We called it the 14-hour condition. And this was to simulate arriving at altitude the night before your race.
Okay.
So when they arrived to the lab, they went in the tent. And all these, we didn't tell them which one they were getting. But they slept overnight in the tent at 8,000 feet, and they did the time trial at 8,000 feet.
Okay.
Then the other one we called the 2-hour condition. And this was, okay, as an example, you fly to Phoenix, you stay the night close to sea level in Phoenix, and then you drive up to Flagstaff and you get there 2 hours before the race to try to minimize that exposure time.
Yeah.
As short as possible. So what we did is these individuals, these cyclists, slept at sea level. 2 hours before their time trial, we turned on the gas and ramped them up to 8,000 feet. Then we did the time trial at 8,000 feet.
Okay.
And we measured everything under the sun. We measured urine output. We measured plasma volume changes. We measured sleep quality in a couple different ways. We measured ventilatory acclimatization. At the end of the day, for the average person, it didn't matter. It didn't matter if you got there the night before. It didn't matter if you got there the morning of. So if you're one of those people who can't get there early enough to acclimatize, and again, now you're talking about your 2 to 3 week period of time.
Okay.
If you can only get there the day before, getting there the day before or getting there the morning of your race, not going to matter.
Okay.
If you have the finances and logistics to be able to do it, there's data by Schuler in cyclists that shows that 14 days is the amount of time that seems to be optimal, with longer than that getting very, very small incremental improvements in performance at altitude. The data I have in runners says it's a little bit longer, more like 19 days. But basically you're talking about, you know, that pretty tight time frame of about roughly 2 weeks is what you'd want if you have the resources to do it.
Perfect. Okay. So if we do have the resources to do that and we get up there, I've heard that during the first week, you should keep your intensity pretty low, reduce your volume, and only add in the high intensity stuff after the first week. What advice can you give to athletes who do go up and are training prior to an event?
You hit the nail on the head. The key one is in that first week, you've got so many hormonal changes that are going on that if you add high stress load in training on top of it, you are probably going to have some issues that could creep up that are not positive for performance. Certainly the two big things that I always tell people to focus on in that first week are hydration, simply because they're usually not used to being dehydrated as much as they're going to be. Focus on sleep and sleep quality, because in most people, they're going to be negatively affected. If you have sleep apnea at sea level, it's going to be exacerbated when you get to altitude. The other thing, though, that I've found that tends to help most athletes when they go in that first week is to try to double up their workouts. And what I mean by that is, whatever sort of volume you're going to do in a day, instead of doing it in a single workout a day, split it in half and do two. And it seems if you do that for the first 3 or 4 days, most people feel like they acclimatize a little better, a little faster than just keeping them all as singles.
Interesting. That's really cool. And then I've heard that if you do intervals, you should double your recovery periods. Do you agree with that?
It depends. Depends on what your goal is. First thing I'd say, if you're going to do intervals, drive down to low altitude if you can do it.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, you can do one of two things. You can either increase the length of recovery, or you can simply shorten the distance that you're going to go on the interval. So in a runner, for example, a common trick is instead of doing 1,000-meter repeats on the track, you do 800-meter repeats on the track at the same pace.
Okay.
So you just go 200 meters less, try to keep that rest interval the same, or maybe tag it on a little bit longer.
Interesting. And I'm guessing when you do these intervals that your intensity, if you're basing it off FTP for cyclists, you're going to decrease that FTP to whatever it should be at elevation, right?
Now, here's where it gets tricky with cycling. It depends if you're doing it on an ergometer, if you're doing it out in the air, because just like you hit a baseball farther at Coors Field, you can ride faster at altitude. So for the same power output, you're going to go faster through the air.
Okay.
You know, so now it becomes the wind resistance factor kicks into play. So you've probably seen some of the data when people try to break the hour world record. They try to go, there's an optimal altitude for it where it turns out in most cases, when you talk about speed through the air, the decrease in air resistance is worth more than the decrease in VO2 at altitude. So you'll actually ride faster in an hour time trial. I think the optimal altitude is around 9 or 10,000 feet.
Okay. So yes, 4,000 meters. That's what I read somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you are on an erg, then you'll drop your intensities to adjust for the elevation change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Okay. So you talked about hydration quick, and it's funny, John and I ski quite a bit, and every time we go to elevation, the both of us, it seems like we have to pee every 5 minutes, like your bladder shrinks. Talk a little bit about hydration at elevation and what we should do if we're up there racing and all that kind of stuff for fueling.
Yeah. It's your bladder's not shrinking. Your kidneys are just kicking in. Overdrive is essentially exactly what's going on. And that's the other reason why, you know, you got to be careful in that first week of training, because you're probably going to get up 2 to 3 times more than you might otherwise get up in the middle of the night to urinate. And it's going to affect your sleep and affect your recovery. With hydration, there's no quick and easy way to do it other than trying to stay cognizant of it.
Okay.
There's no way to trick the body necessarily into storing more water. Some people have tried that with glycerol solutions, trying to do that. Again, you're not going to trick the kidney, especially when you get to altitude, into being able to store more water that way. It's just not only trying to be used to it physically, but used to it mentally. You know, it's the other thing in that first week. It takes about a week for your brain. You're used to, when it comes to breathing, for example, you're used to, what's the number one feedback cue that you have when you're riding of how hard you're working if you can't look at your power meter, right?
My feeling, I don't know.
Yeah, but what's the number one thing that you
respiratory
your
response,
your breathing. Yeah. For people, it's always how hard you're breathing. When you go to altitude, things get screwed up because you're riding or you're running at a lower speed, a lower turnover rate, but your breathing is higher, and your brain in some people have no problem with it. Some people, their brain, I don't want to say freaks out, but that's essentially what happens, and they struggle, and it feels so much harder than what it might be just because of that we call it dyspnea, that respiratory distress.
Okay.
So that's why experience, the second time you go, the third time you go, you don't acclimatize faster. It's the same rate, but you're more psychologically aware of what's going to happen, and you're ready for it.
Okay.
And those are the things, same thing with hydration. It's just knowing it's going to hit you. There's not a lot you can do about it except trying to just stay on top of it.
Okay. So I've read something too, that some studies show that there's an increased reliance on fats for fuel at elevation. Others suggest that carbs are actually more used at altitude. When it comes to nutrition and then racing, should you make any adjustments to your fueling plan or not?
Yeah, for the altitudes that most people are going to utilize, that's not a major concern. Those studies that you reference, those were done at really high altitude. Like we're talking 14,000 feet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
On top of Pikes Peak and military guys, stuff like that. So,
okay.
No real big deal when it comes to, nothing that I would focus on changing other than making sure that iron stores are up, and that whether you prefer to get that through good dietary sources or supplements, that's what you need to focus on.
Okay. And then my last question for this section before we jump into some of the gimmicky stuff, if you can even call it that, is so let's say the guy, a guy works a 40-hour week job. He can't go up 2 weeks before his race, but he can, say, 1 month before the race, go up to elevation, or 1 week. So a month before the race, he has the opportunity to spend 1 week at elevation, and then he goes back down to his normal elevation and then goes back for his race. Will that 1 week, a month before the race, have any positive effect or not?
Probably the only, physiologically, I would say probably not. Psychologically, you get back into that knowing what to expect standpoint, and there I would say it very well can have a positive effect, just from the experience of knowing, again, ventilation, here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen for the first 2 or 3 days when I'm there, and sleeping and dehydrating, things like that.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
Excellent.
John, do you want to get into some of the products?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds good. As far as hypoxia masks, do those work or are they not worth it?
Yeah. So, you know, my colleagues and I in this field, really kind of laugh, at those, especially because they call them hypoxia mask. If they would call it a, respiratory muscle trainer, I wouldn't have a problem. but to call it a hypoxia mask makes absolutely no sense, because the amount of oxygen in your blood is going to be exactly the same. You're not stimulating altitude. All you're doing is putting a resistor.
Yeah.
In your airflow going in and your airflow going out. So one of the gimmicks that we've actually done, again, in my lab's all about how can we either augment your acclimatization response to altitude, or how can we improve your training response at altitude, or these performance questions with acute altitude that we've been talking about. So one of the quote-unquote gimmicks that we tried is we said, well, when you go to altitude, if you breathe more, what if we could train your respiratory muscles before you got there? Then all that extra breathing you're going to do, it's not going to be a big deal. And so there's a lot of inspiratory muscle trainers that are out on the market. You only have to do them like 3 days a week. Some of them you do every day. The new flow resistive ones you do 3 days a week. We had a group of cyclists do it 3 days a week for 6 weeks, and we saw a significant improvement in 20K cycle time compared to a sham group who did it. But with these elevation training masks that they call them, again, they're not simulating altitude at all. In fact, it's easier to breathe at altitude from the mechanical sense of the air is less dense. You can move it out of your lungs with less resistance. So it's exactly the opposite of what really happens.
Did you just say that the hypoxia masks, you saw an improvement in 20K time trials?
Yeah, so we didn't use the hypoxia mask. What we used is an inspiratory muscle trainer device. So there are a number of handheld devices that you can use that are designed to simply train the inspiratory respiratory muscles, both the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles.
Okay.
And they've got some really neat ones. They Bluetooth to your phone, so you can essentially see your maximal inspiratory pressure curves and things like that. And so one of the commercially available ones that we did, it's by a company called Pro2Fit. We utilized their device. We did two groups. One group did 3 days a week of this inspiratory muscle training protocol for 6 weeks. The other group did a sham protocol where we gave it to them with no resistance, told them it was going to do something. And again, the sham group doing a 20K time trial to simulated altitude of 8,000 feet. Sham group, no difference, but a significant improvement, a little over a percent in the group that did inspiratory muscle training beforehand. So our thought is it could be an intervention that you do in the 6 weeks before you go to altitude, so that when you get there, you do this, you're there and you have extra ventilation at any given workload at altitude. And whether it's physiologically or psychologically, it feels easier now that you've done it. It's kind of like, you know, swinging a weighted bat in the on-deck circle. Makes the bat feel lighter when you get it. It's the same sort of concept.
Okay. Cool. Cool.
What about altitude tents? Are they worth the money? Based on what you're saying, it doesn't sound like they are.
The trick with the altitude tents are a couple fold. Again, everybody doesn't respond the same. That's one. The issue with the tent is not how much time you spend in it. It's the amount of time you spend out of it.
Right.
Because as soon as you come out, you're going to start turning everything off. So if you look at the bulk of the data that's out there for the average person, there seems to be a tipping point of roughly 12 hours. And so if in most people for it to be as effective as regular full-time residential altitude training, you've got to be willing to spend about 12 hours a day in a tent. And most people don't want to do that. They want to spend 8 or 9.
Can you do that in intervals where it's like three rounds of 4 hours, or does it have to be continual 12 hours?
Really good question, and we don't have the answer to that. Idea of, like you said, could you sleep 8 hours and then, you know, come home and spend 4 hours in it while you binge Netflix or something like that?
Yeah.
That becomes a problem. The other issue, though, is usually when you're in the tent, most people are going to be lying down. And as soon as you lie down, you start deregulating, you know, you start dumping plasma volume, you're changing some different factors in terms of muscular strength, simply because you're not standing up, moving around. It's the same thing like when astronauts go into space, they have to exercise regularly because gravity is such a huge deal on muscular strength. Well, now if you're spending an extra 4 or 5 hours a day just lying in the bed in a tent, that's a problem.
Okay.
So,
interesting.
It sounds like you could... maybe this would or would not work, but could you create a mask with a tank that you could wear? I mean, this would look weird, but different than the hypoxia mask, but could you limit the amount of oxygen you're taking in and create essentially an altitude environment?
Yeah. So we've actually thought about trying to do this, and you guys lived in Vegas. I know you've been in a casino. Yeah. You've seen one of the elderly individuals playing the slot machine, and they got their little nasal
oxygen
cannulas
tank.
In.
Oh, yeah. Yes, they do.
They either have the tank, or now they have these little, they look like purses, and they're called oxygen concentrators that run on a battery.
Yep.
Well, basically, that's exactly what we would be talking about, but you just reverse it. Instead of concentrating the oxygen, now we're concentrating the nitrogen, pumping through the cannula, and now when you got those in, you're walking around and you're at 8 or 10,000 feet. As far as your body is concerned with the air it breathes. It's a possibility. Now it's a question of, would athletes be willing to do that if they had to do it? And no one studied it yet, but it certainly would be kind of the next step. And you guys as business guys know this, is there a market for it? And could you create a market for it? And if you could, it would be an interesting thing to look at.
Interesting.
Cool.
All right. So now that we're talking about oxygen tanks, you also have supplemental oxygen training. And for those who don't know, you explain what it is and then explain how it would work at, let's say you live in Park City, explain how it would work in Park City. And then my follow-up question is, can sea level athletes over oxygenate below sea level?
Yeah. So, one of the groups that really actually did a lot of the work on this is Randy Wilber's group, who you mentioned at the top of the podcast, he's a senior sport physiologist at the Olympic Training Center. Okay. And in Colorado Springs, they're in a unique situation where they're at about 6,200 feet, but it's really not accessible to get low.
Okay.
Conveniently. So for the cyclists who are there, they said, well, what if we come in and do this hyperoxic training a couple days a week? And so they'd have them on mass breathing tank air that basically took them right down to sea level and saw essentially the same sort of performance response that you would get from doing live high, train low.
Okay.
So it's an artificial way to train low. One of the really interesting outcomes that they saw was when they brought these guys down, they were able to hammer so hard, they would have a lot more muscle damage, muscle soreness after the workouts, both from the fact that they could just, pull more watts, but it was also the extra oxygen also caused some oxidative damage they felt in the muscle. So trying to combine that sort of training with some appropriately timed antioxidant supplements seems to be the way to go. You can actually go below sea level. the trick though becomes there's kind of a limit. You don't want to breathe 100% oxygen
because that's unsafe, right?
Well, it's not it's not so much that it's unsafe. It's just it's not going to do anything for you. So once you load all the oxygen onto hemoglobin, and in other words, let's say these guys riding in Colorado Springs are 82% saturated. Well, if we can get them even on like 30-40% oxygen, that's going to get their saturation up to 100%,
okay,
like it would be at sea level. If you add more, you're really not getting that much more oxygen in the blood. You can dissolve a tiny, tiny bit in plasma. Mm. But it's really not going to do anything to get any more oxygen in. So in the case of what they were doing in those studies, I want to say they were around 40% oxygen, which was plenty. But again, they so there's not much more of an advantage of trying to go any lower simply because you're not going to get any substantially more oxygen in the blood. You just want to correct the deficiency.
Okay. And is this something that's safe or commercially available for athletes to do?
It's probably not commercially available per se, but it's not difficult it wouldn't be too difficult. We simulate altitude in our lab using a typical altitude generator, just like that are commercially available with a tent. We just float into a big, essentially I buy weather balloons, and that's what we flow the air into. And we just hook that up to the mask on the intake side. While the subject rides, and we can simulate altitude that way. Now you're talking about doing the same thing, just using an oxygen tank in reverse. Now, you wouldn't want to get 100% oxygen, so you'd either have to have some sort of valve system to bleed it and mix that in room air together, or you'd want to just buy a tank of 40% gas, but that is a little more expensive to get pre-made up.
Okay, and that is safe.
There's no question it's going to be safe from the standpoint of an athlete. Again, the only thing that's not safe and safe is a
relative always, term.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, they saw a lot of muscle damage, these guys. I mean, they were just hammering these workouts and they get off the bike and, you know, the day or two later, they're still really sore. And these are, you know, guys who are training solid every day, elite guys. So that's the only thing you got to be careful of.
So if we go in the opposite direction and we take that oxygen percentage too low, you can run into something like, you know, acute mountain sickness or something like that. Can you talk about that and when is it safe to return back to a lower elevation if someone were to fall into that?
So you're talking about when individuals go to altitude to train, usually acute mountain sickness normally does not really seem to be a factor until you get above typically 8,000 feet. There are some occasional people who at lower elevations will, see some AMS symptoms. Usually it's headache, is the first most significant one, some nausea. The key things to watch out for is if you have high altitude pulmonary edema or high altitude cerebral edema. Those are the dangerous ones. So if you ever notice you've got like this gurgling in your lungs, that you've got a lot of fluid in your lungs, then you need to get medical care right away. And the first thing they're going to do is they're either going to put you in a hyperbaric chamber to take you down artificially, or you need to get down off the mountain as soon as possible. And in most cases, just with acute mountain sickness, easily correctable by breathing on an oxygen mask or going back down.
Okay. Can that happen at like 13,000 feet?
Absolutely. No question. I may have had that once. Altitude pulmonary edema, cerebral edema at much lower elevations. But usually you don't see acute mountain sickness until 8,000 feet. If for most people that's going to be the threshold, and then the peripheral cerebral edema could happen at those elevations, but usually it's a little bit higher.
Awesome. Okay.
Good to know.
All right. So we got to the final question of this podcast, and it's our question that we ask every guest, and it's called the Watt Point question. So the idea is, if the guest takes all of the advice given to them by the expert on the show, how many watts is that worth? And we always use a 300 watt FTP. So if we'll just go with the altitude training side of this. So if your athlete comes to you with a 300 watt FTP at sea level, you take them through an altitude training camp, how many watts is that worth when they get back optimally at sea level?
Wow, that's a good question. I'll say this, and you guys can help with the math here. So for the typical elite athlete who's been a part of our study, who does live high, train low, and they're an average responder, we usually see about a 5% increase in VO2 max and roughly about a 1.5% increase in performance. And watts and performance time don't necessarily equal each other out.
Okay.
But if you were to do the math, what would you estimate?
I got some exercise science physiologist friends. I might have to ask that too. I don't know what a 5% increase in VO2 max would equate to watts wise, but I'm sure we can find that out. So, and when you say performance, you're basing that on time, right?
Yeah, we've always used time, whether it's, you know, time in a 20K ride or whether it's time in a 3K run on the track.
So a 20K ride, you're seeing a 1.5% increase in performance?
That would be typical.
Okay, so we will do the math on that, and we will add it to the show notes.
There you go.
Cool. Perfect. Well, this, you are absolutely brilliant with this. This stuff, this podcast has been amazing. I'm blown away by all the information. We cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. You're truly one of the best guys in the world to have on this topic. So thank you so much. How can athletes learn more about you and what you do?
Oh, gosh, great question. If you go to Indiana University's website, I'm not a self-promoter guy in any form or fashion. You do a Google Scholar search, you can see some of the work that I've done. If you go to the Indiana University faculty pages, it'll have a link to my CV, and you can get a listing there of some of the papers I've done. And
okay, so there's no business or anything that we can promote for you? Okay. I'm just trying to help you out if we can. So
I appreciate it. I will say, though, I appreciate the things you said, though, but it's been through a lot of the mentors I've had, like Ben Levine, James Ray Gunderson. Those are the true giants in this field, and we all stand on their shoulders when we do this work.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, and thanks for coming.
Yeah, have a great day.
All right, take care.
Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to listen to episode 19, where we interview thermoregulation expert Dr. Robert Casa to learn how controlling your body temperature can keep you safe and help you become a faster cyclist. If you enjoyed the show, please help us by sharing our podcast and by leaving a rating or review. If you want to learn more about our company, Flow Cycling, please visit us online at flowcycling.com. That's F as in Frank, LOCYCLING.com. You can also find us under Flow Cycling on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, ride safe.